Hey everybody, welcome back to Jim David's Icons, and that's me. And the music that you're hearing is, of course, Xanadu by Olivia Newton-John. One of the greatest songs from one of the worst movies ever made, but one of the funniest Broadway musicals ever made. And the Broadway musical of Xanadu was written by the guy that I get to talk today, Mr. Douglas Carter Bean. You know, one thing that I'm very proud of is that pretty much everybody I've talked to on these podcasts has really accomplished a lot, and this guy is no exception. I mean, it's not every day that I get to talk to somebody who has two Broadway shows running at the same time right now. But Douglas Carter Bean does. His two shows right now are his adaptation of Cinderella, the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, and a new play called The Nance, starring Nathan Lane, which I just saw tonight, and I've got to tell you, I absolutely loved it. It is one of the most fascinating and interesting plays I've ever seen because it delves into a whole period in theatrical history where there was a burlesque stock character called a Nance who was, in effect, a flaming homosexual on stage that would get on stage and get laughs. And Doug explains a lot about that character in this interview. If you're in New York City, I would highly recommend that you see The Nance on Broadway. It not only has a killer performance by Nathan Lane, but it's also just this window into this whole era that in the current days of, you know, marriage equality and equal rights. I mean, there was a time when just simply talking to a guy in a certain way would get you arrested. Douglas Carter Bean is probably most well known for his screenplay for the movie To Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar, which was about the three drag queens going across America, played by Patrick Swayze, Wesley Snipes, and John Leguizamo. But he's done a whole lot of other stuff. He did the book for the musical Sister Act. He wrote with his partner Lewis Flynn the musical Lysistrata Jones, which was on Broadway. He did a play called The Little Dog Laughed, which won Tony Awards. He himself has been nominated for 4 Tony Awards. And I've known Doug for a good while, and he lives right next door to me, but he's been so busy that he hasn't had time to come over and talk to me. But now he finally did, because both of his plays opened on Broadway. Isn't that great? It's like, oh, I'll talk to you when my plays open on Broadway. But I'm really happy that I got to talk to him. I think you'll find this conversation very interesting. We really talk about the craft of writing and what it's like to be a working playwright and screenwriter. I mean, this is what the guy does for a living. He writes, and he's very successful at it. So I'm honored to get to talk to him. Please say hello to Douglas Carter Bean.
The question I have for you, first of all, congratulations on your wonderful reviews for
The
Nance.
Thank you. I try to have a show open on Broadway every month.
You because right now you got Cinderella and you got The Nance. Now, how did this happen, like, all of a sudden?
Bad timing. Yeah. Very bad. My iPhone has a schedule and I don't know how to access it. That's why it all happens. No, I Cinderella was going to happen, and The Nance was, I wrote for Nathan Lane, so it was all going to be about his.
How long ago did you write The Nance?
I started it 8 years ago.
And where did the idea come from? Because it's a great idea.
Slap me. He's a vicious, vicious interviewer.
Yeah, I know. It's about this burlesque figure.
Yeah, that it's a character. It's sort of the black equivalent of blackface. It's sort of like that is.
You mean the gay equivalent?
The gay equivalent. He's like, what black is to blackface, gay is to dance. He's just a stock character. He's effeminate. He's sassy, but he's frazzled always.
Right.
And then he sort of like everything Franklin Pangborn did in the movies. And then
the butler in Stage Door, one of the butlers that tiptoes backwards.
And Alan Seuss, you know, would play in life or
on Laughing.
Charles Nelson Reilly and the like. Yeah, this is very effective.
This was an actual stock character in burlesque.
It was, yeah. It was usually done by straight men. Someone recently told me that Red Button started as a Nance.
Really?
Yeah, so, and they were very funny, and they were from an era in New York when openly gay was funny and charming and delightful, the Prohibition. And then by the late 30s, the pendulum had swung, and suddenly they were no longer desirable. And there was an ordinance put in that anyone who wanted to have a license to perform on stage could no longer have Nance acts or, as they've referred to it, deviance on stage.
Really?
Yeah. So it was an interesting story about censorship. It was the idea of a gay man playing an outrageous gay man. And it was about burlesque. It was about cleaning up a city and what that really means to put 7,000 people out of work.
Did you have to do a lot of research?
I did a ton of research, and I did it happily and joyfully. Love research.
You do?
Love it. Yeah. Yeah, and it's so funny because my reputation, such as it is based on contemporary plays about contemporary
Right,
plays.
Right.
Like up to date, like in shows like Lysistrata Jones, I would put jokes in that afternoon. Someone would die.
You had a Marcus Bachman joke in.
Marcus Bachman, we had a Kim Jong-il. It was like the day he died, we put a joke in.
But can I ask you, what happened with Lysistrata Jones on Broadway? It just didn't sell?
It was a marketing thing. It was a business.
It was
some bad business decisions made by some novice producers. And it's sad because the reviews were insane. The word of mouth testing was fabulous.
It got a rave in the Times.
It got a rave everywhere. It was a fabulous show, and it was fun. And now I think some other mediums may come to the forefront with Lysistrata Fever, so that's exciting.
Well, great.
So I love doing research. I love doing the research of the period. I mean, it's of the, and I love watching Turner Classic Movies, so I could write lines that start with "Say you, listen, kid," that kind of rat-a-tat dialogue. I love that. And I wrote it in about a year, the first draft, and I sent it to Nathan Lane, and he loved it and wanted to do it. So we did a reading, and then it was maybe 5 or 6 years of just trying to figure out how and when it would happen. And when they said, "These are the dates," Cinderella was already in the books, going to happen, and I just said, "Sure." And it worked out that Cinderella would open, and then the next day I would start rehearsals for the Nance. And I thought, that's perfect. It's meant to be. But then Hurricane Sandy came and pushed everything back. So our set was pushed back for Cinderella because it was out in New Jersey and got flooded. So we had to start over.
The set got flooded?
Yeah, the set shop. The set shop where they build all the sets New Jersey. So that hit. And so consequently, we pushed back 2 weeks, which meant that I was doing double duty there for a week. And that just about put me in my grave. I went to the eye doctor because my eyes were burning. And the doctor realized that it was from looking at stage lighting too much.
Are you serious?
I know. I was looking at it all day long.
So it was a burn.
It was just a burn.
Corneal burn.
That's right. I just
from the footlights.
From the footlights. Enough. I was like, stop performing, everyone. Stop it. It's killing me. You're blinding me.
Okay. Let me ask you. I'm gonna go backwards with this. I mean, this is all like all over the place.
Like
but
Mr. Peabody in the Wayback Machine.
Exactly. Mr. Peabody in the Wayback Machine. I love a Bullwinkle reference. I just love it. Whose idea was it to rewrite Cinderella? Because it is a book by Oscar Hammerstein, correct?
Well, it's a teleplay.
Oh,
which is my new favorite. It's a teleplay.
Right.
It was
done for television, not the theater.
In 1957, I'm thinking. Yeah, 1957. It was before I was born. That's why it's my only excuse for them not calling me in the first place. It was done as a special for, I'm thinking CBS, because ABC.
I think it was CBS.
ABC had just had a huge success with Mary Martin and Peter Pan.
Peter Pan.
So they wanted one. So they commissioned it. They paid money, good money. Rodgers and Hammerstein to write a fairy tale, and they came up with Cinderella. And it started Julie Andrews and the great Kay Ballard, or as she says on the DVD directors, what do they call that little talk along thing, the little track? Kay Ballard. My good friend Kay Ballard.
Kay Ballard.
So that's become sort of the catchphrase of, anyone. Kay Ballard, my good friend. And then just mispronounce the name.
But whose idea was it to rewrite it?
That was the estate with the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization is run by a man named Ted Chapin, and he was in Israel with producer Robin Goodman. They took a vacation together, And while they were looking, his rocks being thrown at children or something horrible. They said, "Want to do something with Cinderella?" And she said, and Robin Goodman, the girl producer, said, "Yeah, if Cinderella can be a strong character, then I would do it." And then I had a meeting 2 weeks later with Robin about something, a whole other project entirely. And she mentioned Cinderella, and I said, "That sounds interesting, but I'm not going to do that." And I went home, it was the holidays, I went home with the Christmas time, and I was there with my sister and my nieces and my daughter, and we started talking about Cinderella for some reason, and then I went online to find a good version of Cinderella to read to them, and I found this fabulous 1691 version by Charles Perrault, which is the original French version, and I was knocked out because it was so good. It was funny, it was a little moral lesson. It wasn't psychotic the way Cinderella in America is told, where Cinderella meets someone under false pretenses and then is pursued by him, and that's love.
That's, yeah, right.
Gee, and you wonder why 50% of all marriages end in divorce.
It's almost like abuse.
It is, as well, yeah. And it's abuse porn.
It's abuse, it's because it's like she's abused by the stepsisters, and then she's forced to go to the ball, and then the fairy godmother abuses her.
Yeah.
And then the witch.
I don't know.
Oh, that's Snow White. I'm sorry. Story,
but it,
sorry.
But it is an endless, well, you know, it depends on the production. So, you know, I read this original version, and she met the prince a number of times. She changed his view. She changed the court's attitude. They were sarcastic and engaged in ridicule, and she taught them kindness and generosity of spirit. And she befriended one of her stepsisters. The stepsisters weren't ugly. They were just selfish and mean. So I sat down, I listened to the score, and I found some other songs that were cut from other shows, and I came up with a draft, and we read it around a table, and it was, everyone said, "Yeah, this is good." And we said, "We'll be on Broadway in 2 years." And of course, they, people say that, and you go like, "And I'm going to go flap my arms and fly to the moon."
Right, right.
But it happened. Lo and behold, within 2 years from that, we were at the Broadway Theater, and I was on stage taking a bow.
How long did it take you to write it?
It took me about a month and a half.
Of how much writing? Like you're writing, this is what I want to find out. When you write, do you have to go away by yourself, you know, away from Lewis, away from the kids?
I don't. I. Well, no, sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. I mean, you just sort of, usually a first draft of something, I'll go away for a week somewhere. I have an office across the street from our apartment. It's right over there. Sometimes I look in your apartment, I wave at you.
Oh, really? Right over there?
You can't see.
I can't see you.
I can't see you. Don't flatter yourself, ego. I go and I can write and I can be a little away from everybody for a little bit. But no, I tend to write and then I just kind of pick little, I can find little times to write. I'm going to start on a big writing phase now because both my plays are open. So I can just sort of write through and I don't have anything till New Year's Eve really to, so I'm just going to write.
What's going on New Year's Eve?
New Year's Eve is Metropolitan Opera. I do a new version of Der Fledermaus.
Of Der Fledermaus, yeah.
Which is German for the bat. Yeah. So it's just, you know.
What's the big aria in Der Fledermaus?
The big one is the Fledermaus waltz.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
And it's just packed with, it's the top 40 of operetta.
You're right.
Like, yeah, I know that. Oh, I know that.
Your first big, was Tu Wong Fu your first big success? The Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything?
I think it was. I think I have done a commercial play that was No Big Whoop. So that was my first thing. And then I was, you know, a couple years went by and I actually couldn't make a living as a writer. So I started babysitting friends' kids. And all my friends and all their kids went away for spring break. And I was stuck, and I just said, I have to do something quick to change my life. So I said, I'll write a movie that I know they'll never make, but no one would ever do anything like. I'll write a movie about drag queens driving across America in a car. And I wrote it, and I came up with a title that would be unproducible, that would just, because I knew they would get like, The Killing, The Gun, The Bang. And I just said, I'll come up with the title that'll just go, what the hell is this? Came up with the longest title I could come up with. and submitted it. And 4 days later, Steven Spielberg had optioned it. And what?
Who? You're basically an unknown writer at this point. Yeah. Who did you submit it to?
My agent.
You had a writing agent.
Her name was, she has since died and gone to heaven. Her name was Mary Maher, and she was quite brilliant. She called the first day and said, Fox has passed. And I was like, yeah, I think that's what's going to happen. I said, but maybe they'll keep me in mind for something else. And they said, Paramount is going to pass. I said, well, you know, she goes, but they want to meet with you next time you're in L.A. I was like, okay, well, that did something. And then she goes, you're not going to believe this, but we're in the middle of a bidding war with Disney and Steven Spielberg over. I said, you know, they know it's drag queens and not dragons, right? They don't think this is some magical. It's like, no, they know. They think it's fun. It was also a challenge for me, as I wanted to write a G movie. It ended up not being G, but a G movie that was about men in drag. And
where did you get this idea?
It was...
Were you influenced at all by Priscilla?
No, I didn't know about Priscilla. Priscilla actually was happening at the time in... Australia. So I had no idea that I was.
What are the odds? Two drag queen road movies.
I know, and there was like, you just got that right from Priscilla. I say, oh, I wish it was that easy. I wish it was that easy. It was. I got the idea from. This is so. My God, it's so long ago. Let's all imagine a time called 1994. I was home visiting my mom, and RuPaul was on. I think VH1 had a series on VH1, maybe, I'm thinking. But she was performing, and my mom looked at that and said, she's a beautiful girl, but her voice isn't very good. And I went, oh, that's what middle America thinks of drag queens. They just think they're tall women who can't sing. And I went, that's funny. And they're like, what if drag queen was plopped in the middle of America? They would change the town around, and they would never really know. They would just think they were career girls. And that was my idea, crazy premise that it was. And it's sort of like a music, I always say it was like the Music Man with ball gowns, you know. And that's what it was like. And it was hilarious. And then every actor in the world was sending videotape of themselves in drag. And I saw everyone who was famous that I saw in a dress.
In drag?
Yeah, yeah. And I wasn't.
Can you tell any of the people that you guys passed on that look really good in a dress?
John Cusack looks surprisingly like Joan Cusack.
Really?
Like, I actually said, we'll say we hired John and hire Joan, and then let them duke out who gets any award for it. James Spader was beautiful. Stunningly beautiful. John Turturro, heartbreaking.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Just heartbreaking. it was sort of like, oh... If ever a wig and a dress said quit in time, it was like John Turturro in a dress.
That's a riot.
Yeah, it was like a lot of folks.
Because Patrick Swayze is not the first person that I would picture in a dress. Well,
then they got that. Then it was like the interesting actors, like the Willem Dafoe's, you know, who looks like the Joker's sister. But you got all those, and then suddenly you went from being the interesting those actors. And then the action adventure actors wanted to do it, and suddenly they came up with, if it's Swayze and Wesley Snipes, those are action adventure stars, and them doing drag, it's an event. It's a huge event. It's not actory and show offy. It's an event, and it was great, and it was actually a hilarious movie to work on.
Who directed it?
A British woman named Beban Kidron. And she was great. It was my first movie.
And it was a joyous experience from top to bottom.
You're out of your mind. You're out of your mind. Patrick Swayze was nuts. I mean, he's gone now. He's up in heaven. So let us say, not to speak ill of the dead, but it's not ill to say someone's nuts, is it?
He was nuts.
He was nuts.
What was the thing about him hiding in the trailer because there was a drag queen streaker that was coming through the set or something?
No, he would hide in the trailer a lot. He would sort of have breakdowns and go, I'm not pretty enough. I'm like, okay, Patrick. But one of the funniest things ever said was he was a pilot and we were in Kansas and he said, I'm going to fly myself to L.A. And there was a moment of silence and you just saw everyone's head going, they're going to let you in the air where there are birds and other people in planes who could.
But still, for your first movie, that's a big.
I was the only person who wrote that film. I mean, John Leguizamo had a legion of, like, Vietnamese boat people writing jokes and feeding it to him in his trailer. You know, we found that out because he would improvise on the set. I'm going, he's coming up with some good stuff just off the top of his head. I know improv, and I know somebody wrote that improv. And then B. Ben said, I've got an idea. Let's try something. She set up one thing and then slyly, without anyone knowing, set up another set and said, you know what? We're doing the scene before it instead. And you saw John run to the trailer. And he's like, oh my God, they're chained to the trailer.
To get the lines.
To get the lines, give me lines, give me lines. He was like a coke dealer, didn't get more lines.
Well, he was such a good woman. It was scary. I remember I saw him in Mambo Mouth off Broadway when he did he did that transvestite hooker.
Yeah, and he kind of hasn't done it since.
No, but he really knows how to do drag.
Well, that's what I knew him from, that world, from the downtown world, and that was really his first big. I mean, he did the Carlita's Way. He had just done Carlita's Way, but that was his first real thing. But it was a wonderful experience, and that experience taught me about reviews. Reviews in the theater are so important, and we're very anxious about them, and we have nervous moments and flutter. So here come the reviews. What are the reviews like?
Yeah.
With Chuang Fu, they said, we're going to send you the reviews, and it's on a Friday. The movie was released on a Friday, and the reviews were that morning, and there was a knock on the door, and there was a box, and it was, I thought, a phone book, but it was the reviews for the entire country. Everyone who had seen the movie, every review, and I couldn't get a quarter of the way through it, and I just was like, who cares? You know, you become numb to it. You don't care what anybody says, and that was a really wonderful, helpful thing for me to learn at that moment.
What did they say? Were they positive?
They're positive, yeah, overwhelmingly positive, you know, overwhelmingly positive.
But still, after a while, it just didn't matter.
It just didn't, you know, I'm glad they love me in, you know, Detroit and Chicago and Peoria and all those places. But it was sort of like now I have like a Google search where I can, it just come my name every time my name is up, and it's great because I can read reviews of community theater productions of my plays that I wouldn't normally find out about, and I'm always delighted. And for some reason, people and the critics in Texas always want to rewrite my endings of my plays and make them happy. This is sort of a service they provide. Like, instead of a prostitute, if the boy had been a cater waiter or a room service waiter, he and the movie star would wind up happily together instead of being a male prostitute.
That's the little dog laugh you're talking about. Where did you get the idea for that? Because wasn't that based on this whole thing about Tom Cruise? Was it Tom? Somebody was trying to get Tom Cruise to come out or not get him to come out didn't have anything to do with him.
I don't. Here's the hilarious thing about it. It was like little Surrey Cruise was born the day we went into previews with the show. And there were rumors that Tom Cruise wasn't the father, the other actor was the father. And at the end of the play, spoiler alert, that's kind of the ending of the play, is we find another man to father a child with this movie star's fake wife. And there were photographs, and there'll be photographs after photographs. You look enough like the child, you'll be on the cover of magazines. And it was, as this was being said, more magazines were having pictures of it together, and people were freaking out, thinking that I was the most vicious, evil, mean-spirited person ever. But, you know, as Anita Loos says, by way of Laurel Eiley, fate keeps on happening. It just happened.
It had nothing to do with it.
No, and it was actually based on another movie star who a friend of mine had a wild, like, night of sex at a film festival. And as they went down in the elevator, the two of them, just before they got to the bottom and were going to be at the big reception, just before it went bing, the movie star said, "You don't know me? We never met." Bing!
Oh, my.
And they went out.
God.
And I said, that's fabulous. That's theater right there.
Because I remember Paul Rudnick got his idea to do In-N-Out from, you know, Tom Hanks outing his drama teacher.
Yeah.
And so you got the idea for Little Dog Laugh when you heard about that.
Gossip. Yeah, a little story gets me excited, you know, for the Nance. It was finding out that there was this character. Also, just seeing what was happening in America, and the Supreme Court would be looking at gay marriage just as it's about. How does society view gay people, and how does that make gay people view themselves? which is really what it's all about.
Yeah.
I mean, whether or not you want to get married is your business. Who cares? What you want to call a marriage is your business. But the fact that a society says a gay marriage is equal to a straight marriage says that gay people are equal to straight people. And that affects how young gay people feel about themselves.
That's correct.
It's about, that's what it's about for me. And that's what this play, The Nance, was about. And I think it's very moving and exciting for people to watch.
When did you decide to be out in your career?
I never, like 1917, this is Merrily We Roll On, this is where it all goes backwards. 1976, I'm thinking. It was my bicentennial gesture. No, I came out to my family then when I was in high school. And then I came out nationally when they were in USA Today. USA Today.
Oh, God.
I came onto the set of Chu Wong Fu. And it was like, one said, well, you're gay, right? I said, of course. And then it said, Douglas Cardamine, openly gay, which I knew love openly gay, swinging around the room. Yeah, I just remember that I called my dad. My dad has a very wry sense of humor. And I called him to say, I said, you know, just so you know, I came out in USA Today. And he goes, USA Today, they're going to have a pie chart how gay you are? Pie chart. This is how gay is. This is Charles Nelson Reilly, and this is Douglas Carter B. But it is, I do feel a little like, you know, for a playwright to come out as gay is, you know, as shocking as a florist.
Yeah, right.
It really is like no big whoop. And I don't know of any closeted gay playwright. I know there are a few still closeted gay screenwriters.
Sure.
In Hollywood. There's a lot of six. And I was going to say five, and a sixth one came in. And they all have Academy Awards, and they still choose, you know, for whatever reason, just go, my lovely wife, Dolores, can't be here. You know?
They do that? They go that far?
Though they marry, sure, absolutely.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, but don't you think the New York theater is much more of a hospital? I mean, it's almost like being gay in the New York theater is a career move.
The best description ever
was... Do you want some more tea?
No, I'm having a great time. Okay. The best description ever was said to me by a young actress. I said, she was dating this actor. I said, I'm not being rude here, but isn't he gay? Knowing full well that he'd had like a 5-year relationship with a guy. She goes, he's New York gay, but L.A. straight.
Oh, God.
And I'm great. Good. That's good luck with that.
But you didn't encounter any problems at all, really? Because it's...
I wouldn't know. I mean, I came out and I was very open. I was openly gay taking meetings in Hollywood in 92, 93, 94. And... my agent was laughing because he's like, well, he certainly seems comfortable with himself.
Oh, God.
What does that mean? He's not a self-loathing homosexual. He's like a very happy ego.
Because they don't get it. They're not, well, they do, you know, they're even now when I'm in comedy clubs, like a comedian will say something and I'm like, are we back in 1970 with that remark?
Yeah.
You know, they just don't get it.
Gay rights are interesting because... The gay civil rights movement is interesting because it's almost as if, no, it's not almost, it is, that you have to remind people that you're suffering and then ask for the equal rights. It's sort of like before Martin Luther King said, I have a dream. He said, first of all, I want you to know black people are not having a good time. Second of all, I have a dream that we're going to have a good time. You know, when John Roberts at the end of the Supreme Court hearing just like, why do you... gay people certainly have a lot of power.
Oh, God, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But like, what is that power? Or do we just suddenly have everyone realizing how awful we have it? And as on our side, for once, finally people feel crappy about the way... My favorite thing was when Nathan and I did an interview in the New York Times about growing up gay and what we learned about ourselves by what society taught us. And how the Nance was a slang word that is out of use. There were all these comments in the New York Times article, like the little comment section afterwards. And the last one was so sweet. A woman goes, as someone whose name is Nancy, I am very, very ashamed that my name is used to hurt gay people everywhere. I was like, oh, I saw her with her little cardigan sweater over her shoulders. Like, well, now my name is being used to hurt gay people. That's wrong. I'm changing my name to Mary.
Because it was from Nancy Boy. That was British, right?
No,
or was that American?
Nancy Boy. Yeah, there are so many slang words for gay from the 30s. One of my favorite ones is daffodils. and pansies, daffodils. And there's a line in Lullaby of Broadway where she goes, the daffodils
who entertain at Angelo's and Maxie's. Oh, my God.
Which makes me wonder, Angelo's and Maxie's, I wonder what that bar was. Oh, my God. Like.
The daffodils who entertain. I can't believe that is about gay people.
Yeah.
In the gold diggers.
Well, that's, they.
Wow.
They were very, you know, and that was very, New York at that period, the early 30s, was still, had that prohibition vibe to it where every club worth its salt had a pansy. And that was basically a very effeminate gay man who was an MC.
Right.
And we're like, oh, we'll take this outside. I'll have you on the floor, sir. You know, they would just, you know, they would warm up the crowd by just camping it up and teasing all the men.
Because they were harmless.
They were harmless, but the original Nance sketches are interesting that it's a different world. Sexuality is different then. If a straight man gets serviced by a gay man in the 30s, the straight man is not homosexual at all. It's basically he couldn't afford a hooker or he couldn't find a hooker. If a policeman came upon a gay man going down on a sailor, the sailor was let go and the gay man was arrested. If that's what it was. That's,
wow.
So that it was not... You know, it was understood that that's what sexuality was in that time. You have to read George Chauncey's book Gay New York.
I did. All about, I oh, did. I did years ago. I've got to read it again. I'm reading another book right now called Victory: The Triumphant Gay Revolution. Have you heard of it?
No. It's here from when to when?
From the beginning. This is like the whole history of the gay. Everything. Right. It's called Victory: The Triumphant Gay Revolution by Linda Hirschman. And it's quite good. It just gives a whole capsule of description.
I want Linda Hirschman to be a suburban housewife from New Jersey who just said, I want to write about gay rights.
That's Linda Richman.
I want to write about gay. I'm going to pick the kids up from soccer, and then I'm going to write about gay rights.
How did Xanadu happen? Because how in God's name? You know what? I mean, when I saw that movie, and I bought the record before I saw the movie, of course, because I was a huge fan of ELO.
Right.
And I thought, this has got to be the best music from the worst movie.
Oh, yeah. And well, it was, what they did was the producer did studies. And he realized that more people bought the album and had it than saw the movie. More people knew the photographs inside the album than ever saw anything of the movie. So that was actually what I said, so people thought it was good. Or remember it as being, oh, I love that. And it does have a pretty darn great score. So I was offered that, and I passed. Kind of like Cinderella, I passed a lot. I passed that one really a lot of times. And eventually the producer, a young guy named Rob Ahrens, he's not so young now, but at the time he was very young, said, I'll let you do whatever you want. He was desperate for me to do it. I said, sure, okay. So I finally sat down and watched the movie, and I was like, oh, my God, it's worse. It's literally like, at one point, Gene Kelly and Olivia Newton-John are dancing in front of mirrors, and you can fully see the film crew in the mirror. Like, nobody was...
Oh, it's incompetently done.
It's so... And then, you know, and then at the very end, the credits are rolling, and it says, Muse number one, Muse number two. I said, you couldn't even get it together to get, like, a children's book of Greek mythology.
And name them.
And name the muses. And I went, oh, my God. The Muses are coming to Earth in 1980. Hello? Like the end of suddenly it makes sense why there has been absolutely no creativity since 1980, because they left. They were furious. So that made me go, okay, that's what it's about. It's about these Muses. And then I just wanted to feel like Greek theater, like a Seder play. Not Seder as in a Jewish feast.
S-A-T-Y-R.
T-Y-R. Yeah. But a Seder, like a kind of a thing that would be saucy and ribald and make fun of the gods and be something you would see after a lengthy play. And I'm excited to know that a lot of colleges will do like Antigone, and then they'll do it in rep with Xanadu.
Right.
They'll do like the awful, and then they just everyone get to cut off and put on roller skates.
Because it's a scream. Well, let me ask you something, because a lot of your writing, as I know it, has this kind of sensibility, which is not campy, but it's witty. What's the word?
I don't know. You can get anyone you want. They're all good for me. And I'm not...
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, there's a gay...
It's a stupid question, and it's like, how would you describe your... You know, but you have... It's almost like Oscar Wildean...
Well, we should all be so lucky. There is It's Evergrammatic and Chic. I don't know what you would say. I don't know. It is a sensibility. It is, for whatever reason, the movies I liked when I was a kid are movies that I still like today.
Sort of those kind of movies where they say, why don't we see if I can go get a couple of blondes? You know, that
no,
kind of thing?
No, a little more class. I'm thinking a little more like All About Eve.
Stage Door.
Or Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, okay. I love that stuff. And when I write it, there is, I think there's a realness to it. And they're real. It's funny. It's those things. It makes you laugh. I think there's a great deal of heart in my writing. People are very good people trying to make the best they can through a pretty damaged world. And I think I have great affection for people. And I think that comes through. And I try to keep the story twisting and turning in interesting ways.
What do you do when the page is blank and nothing comes?
I do postpone writing. I think of things in my head for a long time.
Uh-huh.
So that when I sit down to write, it's like, oh my God, I have to do this. And then just, I already know like 10 things that are going to be there. So it's just a matter of me looping those 10 things together. If something isn't working on something, I go do something else. I go write something else. And
but then do you also...
Because I don't, I can throw that things in my head because I don't follow sports.
Right.
And have to know any of that information.
Right. How long have you had your kids now?
Cooper's 8, so it's 8 years. 8 years, yeah.
Did you always want to be a dad?
I did. I always loved kids. I always enjoyed.
And Lewis wanted to be?
And Lewis, our first date, that's what he said on our first date. Is that funny? Is that when people say, if you want kids, don't bring it up on the first date because it will just scare people away. And I just said, oh, what the fuck? Let me just ask it this time. And I just said, do you want to have kids? Yeah, I want to have two. I want an older boy and a younger girl. And I was like, oh, wow. He's a man with a plan. I like this. And then... And sure enough, we have two kids. The boy's older.
Oh, that's great.
Life works out, except for you, whoever is podcast listener. Everyone has a great life, but you.
No. My listeners are a loyal bunch.
They're loyal, exactly.
And they're interested in this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you finally got to sit down and talk to me.
I don't know what the hell I've said, and I don't know if anything was funny.
It doesn't matter.
This was
all wonderful.
It's like radio without commercials.
But no, it's fascinating because you're like the only. Actually, I've had a one-time Tony Award sit in that chair. A nominee.
Uh-oh.
One-time Tony Award nominee, but not a two-time. How many times did you?
Four.
What?
Four nominations. Boy, do I know how to lose gracefully.
Wait a minute. Xanadu.
Little Dog Laughed. Xanadu. Sister Act.
Lysistrata Jones.
Yeah. And this year, I will be eligible for two. Maybe three.
God.
Maybe, who knows?
Well, congratulations,
Well, I
Doug.
Love, you know, I just love, God, I don't, it is hilarious that when Tony season happens, it is, you just cannot believe the amount of hoo-ha. There's the amount of lunches and dinners and cocktails, and there are all the other awards. Because the theater people, there really is no money to be found in theater. But damn, we can have an award.
Oh, yeah.
Because we'd have elegant speeches about with earth-shaped tones about the choices made from Aristophanes on. You know, and that kind of...
One of these days, if I ever win an award, I want to get up and just do Eve Harrington's Sarah Siddons speech. Just verbatim, you know. You know, how can I not thank Margot Channing?
Margot. A friend of mine was at a party with Joseph Mankiewicz, who wrote the screenplay, and said, this friend of mine just says, what's your story? Tell me something nobody knows. Tell me something nobody knows. That's what he was saying. He goes, tell me something nobody knows about All About Eve. And he goes, Eve's a dyke. And suddenly, if you watch that last scene with the girl...
Oh, sure.
It's like, lesbian.
Of course she is. I got that the first time I saw it. You know, yeah. It's like she's in there with this girl and, you know, this little Phoebe.
That's what I call it myself.
That's
Then you got to see that. If you can, before you die, dental listeners, try to be in a room full of gay men. Just when Phoebe says, that's what I call myself, it's a touchdown. It literally is, it's a homosexual touchdown.
It's like
woo, woo!
Thanks a lot, Doug, and congratulations on having two Broadway shows on at the same time. If you're listening to this, you are obviously interested in the theater, and I wanted to alert you, those of you who don't know, the new listeners to this podcast, of my novel, You'll Be Swell, which is all about what it's like to struggle in the theater. And you can get it on Amazon and Kindle and Sony e-reader and iBook and all over the place. It's still selling. I'm so thrilled. Until I have two Broadway shows on at the same time, my novel's going to have to suffice. So thanks a lot, guys.